You're listening to The Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, and I'm here as usual with Prashant Parameswaran, my colleague at The Diplomat. How's it going today, Prashant?
Good, how are you?
Good. So last week, Prashant, we talked about the impending ruling in the South China Sea, which has now come out. On Tuesday this week, a five-judge tribunal at The Hague, at the Permanent Court of Arbitration, announced its long-awaited ruling in the Philippines case against China's maritime entitlement claims in the South China Sea. The results were quite spectacular, frankly. I don't know that too many analysts expected the court's verdict to be the way that it was. Specifically, and we won't go too far into the legal details on this because it is quite complicated, and I'm not a maritime law expert, and the ruling is 500 pages long. But very broadly, the Philippines had submitted 15 questions to the international court to decide the tribunal. And essentially, the tribunal ruled, with a few exceptions, ruled in the Philippines' favor overwhelmingly. And the small exceptions were there was just one jurisdictional exception where the court said it couldn't rule on issues surrounding Second Thomas Shoal because of the involvement of the military there. Under the UNCLOS compulsory dispute settlement mechanism, any sort of military activity is out of scope. And then the second issue where the court disagreed with the Philippines was just on the status of a few features. It essentially disagreed with the Philippines that Gavin Reef North and McKinnon Reef were low tide elevations and that Gavin Reef South was a rock. It actually ruled the opposite on both counts, but that's a minor detail. So again, just very broadly, it also invalidated China's nine dash line claim, which is really the big kind of the big decision here. I mean, the nine dash line claim has never fully been clarified by China what exactly it means. It essentially asserts some sort of ambiguous claim to almost 90% of the South China Sea. In addition to doing that, the court also rebuked China's claim to historic rights in the South China Sea, and we can talk a bit more about that later, Prashant. Significantly, the court ruled that none of the features in the Spratly Islands are islands under international law. And I talked about that in more detail in the last podcast episode, but basically, if something is an island under international law, it's entitled to a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone, whereas if it's a rock, it's only entitled to a 12 nautical mile territorial sea. So surprisingly, actually, Itu Aba, which is the Taiwanese possession in the Spratlys, which is the largest natural feature there and essentially has, you know, fresh groundwater and a permanent human presence there, was said to not be an island. And the court actually made an interesting sort of legal determination that islands essentially needed some sort of permanent human community there. And Itu Aba hasn't been, wasn't able to support human life before the Second World War, for example. And there's a few other details there. They're actually really spelled out in some great detail in the ruling itself, where the court outlines its legal reasoning and the evidence it used to come to its decisions. But enough about the ruling. And while it is very interesting, we have a lot more detailed analysis at The Diplomat that you can read, and I can link to that in the description to this podcast. But Prashant, what I really want to talk about now is what happens next. I mean, we've been waiting for this moment for 3 years while we've been watching the South China Sea disputes very closely. But there's a lot of questions now. Specifically, what does the Philippines do? What does China do? What does the United States do? What does ASEAN do? So I want to just go through some of those questions with you now. So since, you know, you're our resident Southeast Asia person, do you want to take us through how the Filipinos have reacted to this very, very favorable verdict by the international court?
Sure. So essentially, the Philippines, it's kind of an interesting case because even though the case was filed under the then Aquino administration back in 2013, there's now a new president, Rodrigo Duterte, in the Philippines. And Duterte, even before the ruling came out, had signaled a very much more conciliatory position towards Beijing in terms of opening up negotiations, as we talked about earlier, and also joint exploration. Now, even the Aquino administration had said that it would be open to this with Beijing, so it's not necessarily a huge departure from where we would have been at. But nonetheless, the tone so far has been quite significant for those of us who watch the Philippines quite closely. Now, the interesting thing about the ruling is the fact that it sets very clear parameters for the Philippines in terms of how it's going to go about doing things like joint development. I think we discussed previously last week as well before the verdict, the Philippine Constitution also contains specific things about what the Philippines can do and cannot do. So that has been a very important part of the debate that's playing out domestically in the Philippines. Now, how should the Philippines now open up talks and negotiate with China? In doing so, in pursuing these negotiations, Duterte has at least signaled that he wants to have the former leader of the Philippines, Fidel Ramos, who backed his candidacy, to go ahead and negotiate on behalf of the Philippines. Now, Duterte unfortunately has not really articulated how he's going to go about negotiating this, and he has put the horse before the cart a little bit, in the sense that he has said that he's going to negotiate with the Philippines and he's going to send an envoy, but he hasn't really tried to appease the national sentiment in the Philippines about what he's going to do. And I think that's going to be an interesting thing that plays out in the coming weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about this privately, Prashant, that a lot of South China Sea analysts didn't really factor the Duterte factor until late April, when people started actually looking at the polls and reckoning with the fact that this person might become the next president of the Philippines. And now here he is, and he's clearly taking a very different tack from the Aquino administration. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. And Ramos, as I take it, hasn't actually accepted Duterte's
Right.
overture. It's just a possibility. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the Chinese reaction, I think, is very interesting as well. It's something I've been keeping a close eye on. I did a piece for The Diplomat where I looked at the first 36 hours after the ruling, and really the Chinese reaction has been quite muted. There's a lot of notable things that China didn't do that a lot of analysts had maybe been a little bit overzealous in predicting. For example, some people predicted that China would lash out against the court and declare, an air defense identification zone, potentially announce its intent to withdraw from the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, or maybe even announce straight baselines around the Spratly Islands. It's done none of those things so far. It made one very small kinetic move in the South China Sea, which was that it flew a small Cessna aircraft from Mischief Reef to Subi Reef, to Spratly Features, where it has airstrips. Apart from that, you could potentially read the downing of the PCA website as a potential kinetic reaction, but I wouldn't really stress that, since it's very difficult to attribute, a potential cyber attack there. We don't know who was responsible. The court did say last summer that it had been hacked, and we also noticed a similar outage last fall when the ruling on jurisdiction came out. So there have been incidents like that in the past. But really, I mean, it seems that China is reacting somewhat positively to the Duterte overtures. I mean, obviously, the rhetoric that's come out from the Chinese government and the foreign ministry has been unequivocally harsh. The Chinese ambassador speaking in DC on Tuesday essentially charged the judges with professional incompetence in their ruling. And the foreign minister said that this is null and void. China won't recognize it. But none of that should be really surprising. I mean, China had said that it would reject the ruling beforehand. So really, we expected a harsh rhetorical reaction. But anything in your view that's significant about the Chinese reaction that I didn't mention?
Right. I think two things have been interesting. I think one has been you touched on this a little bit, sort of the Sino-Philippine relationship and angle. The Chinese have been saying that they're open to negotiations, but they have said that they're only open to this if the Philippines goes ahead and sort of ignores the tribunal or sets aside the tribunal. Now, from the Philippine domestic context, as I mentioned earlier, this would be unacceptable to most people because the Philippines has already come up with this ruling. So that's going to be interesting to see how the Philippines sort of goes through this with the Chinese in the coming weeks. So the second thing is there were reports as of today that the Chinese have stopped Philippine vessels from approaching Scarborough Shoal. And Scarborough Shoal, as we've talked about earlier, has been a flashpoint in Sino-Philippine relations because the Chinese seized that feature back in 2012. So I haven't seen further reports on specifics since the news came out. But if that is something that we're going to see more of, that will create another problem in terms of how the Philippines and China are going to approach things, but also the United States. The United States has been very clear that any attempts by the Chinese to start land reclamation, which they have not done up to this point, would be very destabilizing.
Right. I think it's also worth noting that, the Coast Guard activity at Scarborough Shoal is essentially something that was happening before the ruling as well. So I wouldn't read it as necessarily a sign that China is clamping down, more that it's just continuing the status quo ante. But, I also want to go back to something you said before about Duterte and the possibilities for bargaining here. One of the reactions I actually had after the ruling is that, and this is a little counterintuitive, is that by being so much in favor of the Philippines' submissions on these issues and ruling, for example, that none of these features are islands and that Mischief Reef and Second Thomas Shoal are part of the Philippines' continental shelf, the court actually makes it very difficult for the Philippines to realistically concede anything. You've obviously pointed out the other important issues, which include the constitutional restraints on what Duterte can and cannot do and what public opinion will and will not allow. But there's also the issue that, if Duterte even thinks about offering any concession on something that the court has said is the Philippines' rightful entitlement under international law and UNCLOS, that's just simply a non-starter. And, in my reading of the award, it seems like the one small window of opportunity, and here we come back to the age-old issue of Scarborough Shoal. So Scarborough Shoal is a potential where the court essentially said that both China and the Philippines have a right to fish there. So the Philippines might look to work that as a possible opportunity for a bargaining with China, but China essentially holds the chips there, as you just said. I mean, the Coast Guard is still preventing Chinese fishermen access, so China would have to make the first move, and there's no chance, like you pointed out, that the Philippines would be able to set aside this ruling to continue with its negotiations with China. But let's also move on and talk about some of the other reactions here. And here I'm interested in your perspective on the reports that we've seen that ASEAN is planning on not taking any position on this issue. And I don't know how accurate those reports are. I mean, obviously the ministers haven't met yet and that might change, but obviously the precedent here isn't great given what happened in Kunming a month ago. What's your read on that?
Right, so I think as of a few weeks ago, the Hun Sen came out and gave a very brazen speech where he said Cambodia was not going to participate in any kind of joint ASEAN effort to speak about the verdict in any way possible. And in fact, if ASEAN were to try to do something like that, he said that Cambodia might even issue a statement that was against the verdict. The Cambodian Foreign Ministry decided to, for the first time over the weekend, clarify what Hun Sen had said, and essentially it maintained what he had said in terms of Cambodia not willing to join on to any common ASEAN statement. So once that had happened, most people had found that that was a blow to a potential adoption of a separate statement by ASEAN on the verdict itself. Now, I think what most of us would still hope for would be a joint communique after the ASEAN foreign ministers meeting that still mentions the key principles that ASEAN stands for, but also mentions in some way, maybe if not directly, the verdict, the need for all countries to take peaceful means to resolve their lingering disputes, but also the importance of international law and the need for all countries to abide by that. And if you find that kind of wording in an ASEAN joint communique, once the foreign ministers meet, I think most of us would be pretty satisfied with that, even though, as I've written before, if ASEAN were to adopt a separate statement on the verdict itself, it would be in ASEAN's interest to do so. All 10 ASEAN countries have an interest in the South China Sea, but also in the principles that undergird it, including the fact that might does not make right. But also, secondly, ASEAN has done this before with respect to other issues. When North Korea fired missiles early January, ASEAN issued a separate statement then saying that this undermines peace and stability. And back in May 2014, during Myanmar's chairmanship, ASEAN issued a separate statement on the South China Sea saying that it was concerned about eroding trust and confidence there. So this would not be something that is unprecedented, but clearly Cambodia and to a lesser extent Laos have both very clearly determined that they don't want to participate in anything like that. The last thing I'll note about ASEAN's response is that we have seen a majority of ASEAN countries come out with their own individual statements, as was expected. And the last time I checked, the countries that have not done so are Cambodia, Laos, and Brunei. So the interesting thing will be to see if we do see anything coming out of these three countries.
Right. And to my knowledge, you know, none of the ASEAN members, including, you know, the claimants like Vietnam and Malaysia, obviously you just mentioned Brunei hasn't done a statement, but they haven't actually called for the for the ruling to be respected, nor have they pointed out that it's final and binding, have they?
Exactly. And in some cases, and the particular case that I would point out is Thailand, they didn't even mention that any kind of international legal decision had even occurred.
Right.
The Thai statement just called for peace and stability in the South China Sea, so.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like you know, we do best not to hold our breaths for something like, you know, the forceful statement that we saw at Sunnylands incorporating something on the award when the ministers meet in Laos in just a matter of days now. But we'll find out soon enough. You know, another thing I'll point out is that it is interesting to note the countries that have called for the ruling to be respected and for the ruling to be considered final and binding. And the three big ones are obviously the United States, Japan, and Australia. And all three of these countries had issued similar language beforehand. So that's not really that surprising. India is a little bit of an interesting case here that I just want to talk about very briefly. So India in 2014, India and Bangladesh had both submitted a maritime dispute. It was actually very similar. It was a UNCLOS Annex 7 compulsory dispute settlement, again, you know, adjudicated by a five-panel judge at the Permanent Court of Arbitration. India lost that, but India and Bangladesh both acknowledged the result as final and binding, and that essentially, you know, marked one of the successful cases. But India surprisingly hasn't, well, maybe not so surprisingly, but it hasn't come out and said that the ruling should be directly respected or that the ruling is final and binding. India has essentially noted the agreement. And just today, actually, India and Japan, their defense ministers met and issued a statement, and that didn't represent, you know, any expansion of Delhi's position. And there's a variety of issues and reasons here. I mean, obviously, India has to consider its bilateral relationship with China, even though it's increasingly becoming more and more a part of the United States's principal security network in Asia. You know, this does show that there are still some limits on how far New Delhi is willing to go with its support for the liberal international order, you know, rules-based arbitration. You know, Delhi also has its own concerns about third-party arbitration, given the issues in Kashmir. I mean, that's a different issue because it's territorial, and this is about maritime entitlements. But it's clear that, you know, India does is showing some limitations here.
I think of the three countries you mentioned, U.S., Japan, and Australia, I think the U.S. rhetorical response has been very notable. The U.S. has tried not only individually, but has also been telling some of its partners as well to sort of adopt a more restrained approach following the ruling. And of course, you know, one doesn't need to tell the Philippines that under Duterte, but I think some of the other countries and the United States have been very clear about trying to call for a restraint and trying to give China some space if it wants to find a more restrained approach itself to the ruling. And I think thus far, I would agree with you know, your assessment that you wrote for The Diplomat that compared to some of the nightmarish scenarios that some had talked about before the ruling, we haven't seen a very strong, assertive response by China yet. That may change in the next few weeks, in the next few months. China may still be considering what to do and how to calibrate its actions, and we could see that. But nonetheless, I think it's notable that in the past few days, at least, we haven't seen these major provocative actions. Particularly, even though it has said that it has the right to have an ADIZ in the South China Sea, which it has said before, it hasn't actually moved towards doing it, and that obviously would be a very provocative action.
Yeah, and you know, one final thing I just want to talk about is the issue of, you know, the next U.S. Freedom of Navigation operation. I think we can expect that to happen at some point in August, just based on the timing between the last operations. And this will be the first one after this ruling, and it'll be interesting to see if the United States is going to do something a little bit more provocative, like do an operation that asserts high seas freedoms around Mischief Reef, for example. And, you know, that will be interesting because all the freedom of navigation operations we've seen so far have been innocent passage and have been a little bit more restrained. I mean, China obviously right. sees them as highly provocative and an example of U.S. militarization in the South China Sea. And Mischief Reef is actually really interesting after this ruling. I mean, the court ruled that it's part of the continental shelf and EEZ of the Philippines, yet it's one of China's artificial islands. So now, you know, China has this dual-use facility with an airstrip inside the Philippines continental shelf, and that's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to exchange hands. I mean, that's going to be a flashpoint for the foreseeable future. I mean, I don't see any real way that the Mischief Reef situation is ever going to be walked down. I mean, you know, barring some sort of miraculous diplomatic breakthrough that I think is not very likely at this point.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think we've outlined a good variety of things to watch for here in the coming days, weeks, and months. It's clear that this ruling is really a watershed moment for the South China Sea disputes. You know, we haven't talked about the issue of Vietnam potentially pursuing its own arbitration against China. Building on this, obviously, that would be, again, a huge, be perceived as a hugely provocative move by China. But yeah, there's a lot to watch for here, Prashant, and I guess we'll keep on keeping on at the diplomat and keep our eyes on this.
Indeed.
All right. Well, thanks for joining me today. And for our listeners, make sure you leave us a rating. And I know we've done a bunch of South China Sea podcasts in a row, but you have my word that we will try to branch back out into some other topics. It's just been a particularly busy summer for the South China Sea. But I think, you know, with this ruling, we'll try to turn our attentions elsewhere for now. Thanks for listening.